Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. In episode 18, season 1, I really enjoyed my conversation with the inspiring multi-style violinist Gina Burgess. During the episode, she plays a couple of her original tunes, and at the end we did an improv back and forth across our Zoom call. Gina is a founding member of the Iqaluit-based Arctic rock band, the Jerry Cans, is a four-time East Coast Music Award winner with the band Gypsophilia. She fronts her own klezmer band, Der Heiser, and is a regular collaborator in flamenco and Arabic music ensembles. Gina has toured Europe twice over with Tim Crabtree's atmospheric ensemble, Paper Beat Scissors, and with folk pop artist Gabrielle Papillon. Along with the Jerry Cans, Gina has performed and conducted youth workshops in Canada, Australia, Greenland, New Zealand, and Europe. In this conversation, we talked about Gina's path from her identity as a classical violinist through overcoming an overuse playing injury to finding her voice as an improviser and composer. We discussed music education quite a bit and some of the ways she's led youth workshops. Gina has a wonderful energy to her, and I hope you'll discover more of these conversations with a wide range of musicians by following this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. All these episodes are also available as videos. The link is in the description. Good morning, Gina Burgess. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So, thanks for agreeing to play at the beginning of this.
I'll play a tune called Green Grass. And I wrote this tune after I sat in with a real bluegrass band, and I realized that I do not know how to play bluegrass. So this little tune came to me the day after, and it was also like the same week that Canada legalized marijuana. So I thought it was Green Grass was a very appropriate name for this song. So it's just a little fun, folky tune. And I also do this one with a lot of my students, actually, because you can, I'll just very briefly show you. That's the first part. Very basic. So little kids can play the open E, the other ones can play, you know, so there's lots that you can do with it. But then I show them the full meal deal, and I think it's exciting for them. It's exciting to play, so. With the whole band, it's even more exciting, but I'll give you a little taste.
Tune and so well played.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah. As we're speaking now in August, this will come out a bit later, you've just started performing in person more for people. You just came back from a tour after this long pandemic hiatus.
Yeah.
So how does it feel to be doing that again?
It felt amazing and scary too, you know, just to be honest. I think it's been a year and a half, and so certain social things have become normal, like wearing masks. In Nova Scotia, like, I wouldn't even imagine leaving my house without a mask, you know? In other parts of Canada, that's not the case. So it just was a little different, you know, and kind of coming out of the shell again. But it was super awesome to see people who love music so much, you know, that they're at these first concerts and just right up front dancing, loving life, loving music. It felt really good. Yeah.
So, you have a really interesting career. You've been a full-time touring musician for, I think, over 15 years, and you came from a classical background. And I would describe you as you're a multi-style player and singer, you say? So do you want to start more at the beginning or more your projects right now?
Doesn't matter. Where would you like to start?
How about when Gina was a kid?
Okay. I like to share this story because it's true, and it's the reason I started playing music. So my dad's folks are both classical musicians. My granddad is a conductor, double bass player, organ player, and my grandmother is a cellist. So when I was 3 years old, I went to go see Nanny and Granddad and a woman named Gina playing Beethoven trios. So Granddad was on piano, Nanny was on cello, and this girl Gina was on violin. And I thought, like, my name's Gina. I'm going to do that. I want to do that. And I loved the music. But my parents, I mean, I'm 3 years old, right? So they didn't believe me. And it wasn't until I was 5 years old that they bought me my first violin, because I kept begging them and, like, picking up little Kleenex boxes and playing with pencils and stuff. So when I was five, they bought me a violin and put me into lessons at the Maritime Conservatory in Halifax with my young Joy Yoon, who is an incredible human, and I studied with her from when I was five until I was 16. Yeah, so that's how it all got started.
And then did you think at that point when you were 16 that you would be like following a path as a orchestral player or chamber musician, or were you already doing some different folk styles?
Yeah, well, I was playing in the youth orchestra, and I loved playing orchestral music, loved it. I also loved chamber music. I had a string quartet. We did gigs. Like, I had a gigging string quartet, and then I had a, like, competition string quartet. So I always loved chamber music. And I was doing quite a bit of solo stuff. So I had my first, I played the Beethoven Romance, actually, with Symphony Nova Scotia. I think I was 17 or 16. So honestly, I actually kind of saw myself as going into a more of a solo violin, classical violin career.
Yeah.
At that point.
And what changed?
Well, I got a repetitive strain injury. Yeah. From playing the violin and practicing a lot, so many hours of practice, my goodness. So then I had a choice to make when I was able to use my hands again, and I had to decide if I wanted to continue to study the violin again, like relearn it. I had to relearn it or do something else. And I think just my love of music is so strong, and I also didn't do anything else in my life. I decided to relearn the violin, and that was extremely challenging. Like, I have so much admiration for people who learn to walk again or learn to use their hands after a stroke. Like, it's just so tedious, the work that you have to do. And when you're a child, you don't know any different, you know, so you learn how to write. But as an adult, learning how to write again is like, it just takes so much discipline. So for the violin, it was exactly that. I would, for weeks on end, pick up the violin and just put it there. Hold it there for a few minutes, not even 2 minutes, put it down. That was my practice for that day. Pick up the bow, see if I could hold it. That would be my practice, put it away. And then for months, I would do finger one, finger two, all over again. And it was around that time that a friend came back from music school, and he also had a repetitive strain injury on guitar. And he was telling me about Django Reinhardt, actually. And he said, have you ever heard of this music? And Stefan Grappelli. And I did not know about those guys. But as soon as I heard the first song, I was hooked. Like, yep, this is what I want to do. And because that music is so based around scales and arpeggios, I was able to use that music as a way to relearn my instrument. So that's exactly what I did. Yeah.
So how long did you have to stop playing for? completely?
About a year. Yeah, and it was pretty brutal because I was at Dal on a full scholarship for music. And for the first 2 months, I couldn't even use my hands at all. Like, I couldn't cut my food, I couldn't wash my hair, put on my socks, any of those things that we just so take for granted, you know. Yeah, let's not take those things for granted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you entered this jazz path, but you had been playing Celtic music before that?
Yeah, so when I was 9, actually, my folks picked up a Cape Breton fiddle book on one of their trips to Cape Breton. And again, because I was reading music, I could just read the music in the book. And I really enjoyed the sound of that music. Of course, this is pre-internet, and I had never really heard a lot of Cape Breton fiddle. But after I started to play it, I started to look more into recordings and tapes and stuff from the library. And I heard fiddlers play it, and I thought, oh, that's how you play it. There's so much that's not on the page,
yeah.
You know? So I started to, like, kind of incorporate that, and that's exactly what I learned with the hot jazz as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so much of it you can see on the page, and then the rest is all just your own, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When a person looks at your website and you've listed all your many collaborations, you've been a session musician for so many different artists, different styles, toured all over the world, like, what's it like just being constantly on the road and for very long tours? How do you manage that?
It can be super exhausting. Yeah, as we were just saying, this little dip back into tour life, there was only 3 gigs, you know.
Okay.
And I thought after those 3 gigs, poof, I'm done. Like, I don't know how I did this. But certainly there are tips or different things that have helped. Like, I got into yoga. So there's quite a lot that you can do with just breathing techniques to wake you up or put you to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have some things that we like to do on the road as well. Find swimming holes, you know, that's very reinvigorating. And also just feel so good to be in nature and to be in water. Drink lots of water, you know. So certainly my alcohol intake has, like, gone down. My water intake has gone up. That helps a lot. But also just the energy of the audiences. I mean, sometimes I think audiences feel that they're there and not participating necessarily, you know. But for me, they're more of the show than we are, because we could be playing that stuff. I mean, we saw that, all of this online stuff, you know, and it's great, but it's not the same. And you don't have that same energy exchange at all.
Yeah.
So I think that's a big part of it, is you get energy from the humans and the life around you.
And I've noticed your role in different bands you play with is very often very rhythmic as well as melodic.
Yeah, I love to play rhythm. Yeah.
So that gives you energy too, like you're part of the rhythm section, you're driving.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Driving the dance, essentially.
Yes, I love to dance too. So I'm one of those people, like, you'll just see me, even
yeah.
at, like, a restaurant, if there's a tune on, like, I can't sit still. I just can't.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's part of the energy exchange as well.
I wanted to ask you about education. I know you've done a ton of youth outreach, different kinds of workshops. You've taught, obviously, private, but a lot of group stuff, both online and in person. I noticed you'd led workshops in Greenland and just, like, all over New Zealand. So I'd love to hear about some of the ways you're working with kids and different kinds of techniques you use.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been teaching and working with people younger than me since I was 15. It started in junior high. Actually, my string chamber teacher asked me to help out somebody that was a couple of grades below. And I never even contemplated that, but I did. I had a session with her and I realized, like, oh, you came in and you couldn't play this and now you can play this. So I guess there's something happening, you know, and I loved it. I loved it. So that started my, like, teaching, I guess, if you will, or coaching. And then I'd say it really started on my very first trip to Iqaluit, because I went up there. I thought I was going up there as a chaperone, which I was totally cool with. You know, I taught the kids down in Halifax a tune, a non-classical tune, and I was going to go up there and watch them and play with them. And actually, we all were able to sign up for different workshops when we got to Iqaluit. And this was a youth exchange between the conservatory and the Iqaluit Fiddle Ensemble. And so I signed my name up for a throat singing workshop because I've been also obsessed with throat singing since I first heard it. I think I was 21 or something. And my boss basically said, well, oh, I noticed you're signed up for throat singing. Well, who do you think is giving the fiddle workshop? And I said, well, I don't know, some local person. And she's like, no, you are doing the workshop. And I had no teaching materials whatsoever. No music, no sheet music, no books, nothing. Just me and my fiddle. So I thought, oh man, okay. And it was fine. It was totally great. We learned by rote. We played hot swing music. We played fiddle music, improvising games, whatever I could do without any materials. Mm-hmm. And it was great. 5 days went by, boom, they learned a bunch of stuff. It was great. So I think that gave me the confidence to know, like, oh, it's actually me as a human being interacting with these people. The violin is a tool, you know, for that energy exchange, really. And so it was that trip, actually, that I stayed with a woman who recently passed. So I'm so thankful to her for many things. But her son actually was looking for a fiddle player to teach music camps in different, more remote parts of Nunavut. Mm-hmm. So she asked if she could give my name to him. And that started, in a way, the Jerry Can Band, mm-hmm. you know? So I started going up doing these music camps with Andrew. And we had some different people coming in at that time. Silo was doing hip-hop dance for a little while. Kathleen and then Nancy were doing throat singing. Andrew was doing guitar. I was doing fiddle. Sometimes we had accordion. Mm-hmm. And we did those camps in different communities for almost 6 years. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of similar stuff. Those games, the improv games, a lot of Murray Schafer, like listening games, which are super cool to do in the Arctic because those kids have completely different environment, completely different ears than we do, especially in big cities. So we did a lot of that stuff. I mean, as a touring band, some circuits, you have the choice if you want to do teaching, if you want to go play in elder facilities. So we would always sign up to do the youth workshops because we love working with kids and going to schools. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the schools wouldn't always have instruments. Presumably it would be vocal or clapping or...
Yeah, often. Sometimes they would. I was kind of surprised actually to see how many schools invest in music. Mm-hmm. It's heartwarming.
Yeah. So I had heard there was a bit of a fiddle tradition up north because of the Scottish Whalers that had come through, and it's same with accordion.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. They're actually considered traditional instruments now.
It's been a couple hundred years.
Yeah.
And someone who grew up in the classical world kind of glued to the page, and now most of your career has been playing more by ear and by memory, does it free you up?
Yes, it does. It does, but sometimes I long for the page, mm-hmm. you know, especially when it comes to practice, at home practice. Mm-hmm. If I'm practicing improv, sometimes, depending on my mood, my project, whatever, I just sit there and I think, I don't have anything to say right now. You know, I don't have anything, I don't know how to practice this right now. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you give me a Mozart string quartet, okay, boom, I'm on it, you know? So sometimes I long for that, just know what to do, correct it, execute it. Next. Mm-hmm. With the improv, it's so ongoing and it's so forever, you know, and depending on the genre that you're working within or the project that you're hired for, mm-hmm. It's infinite, really. But I prefer to practice that kind of stuff with other people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have like a technical routine that's kind of your go-to for staying in shape?
I would actually say yoga.
Okay.
So not so much on my violin anymore, you know. Again, growing up, I did the whole like 1 hour of scales, 1 hour of studies, 1 hour on one piece, another hour on another piece. Like I did that, you know, and I'm glad I did because I feel like now I don't have to do that mm-hmm. for what I'm doing. So my practice for keeping in shape is actually yoga and keeping the core engaged and strong mm-hmm. so that when I go to play my instrument, it's ergonomic and it's not going to throw me back into an injury state, you know? Mm-hmm.
But if you were working with a young person who was very serious about violin. I mean, would you have them doing that kind of regime, or would you have them exploring different styles and trying to reduce the number of hours they work so they could be more sensitive to ergonomics?
Definitely. Yes. So as a teacher, if you're going to come study with me, I tell you right off the bat, you are going to have to do classical music and you're going to have to choose something else. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to do that, fine, but you can't study with me. So that's my rule, my hard rule. And like classical is the basis, so that's what we're going to be doing. And then you can decide, do you want to do hip hop? I've had kids who have only done hip hop. Do you want to do Cape Breton fiddle? Do you want to do a swing or klezmer stuff, you know? So they choose their other, but the foundation is going to be classical for the technique. Mm-hmm. I certainly do not encourage hours and hours of practice every day. I encourage less time consistently throughout the week. So, and then also thinking about it, like practicing without your instrument, you know? So singing your songs, listening to your songs, moving while you listen to a song, like that kind of stuff, so that you can internalize if you're trying to memorize a piece of music or something like that. Mm-hmm. So just kind of different techniques. Mm-hmm. And I do really, really like working one-on-one with the individual that's in front of me. So I can really see their likes and dislikes and what they're drawn to, how they prefer to work, you know, and then kind of go that route rather than one size fits all, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I've only done, I mean, I've, you know, taught master classes and stuff and workshops, but never, I've never done class teaching. To me, that's so intimidating, especially with violin. I guess people have their ways of working, but it's so important to have music in schools. And it's, at least in Ottawa, it's very rare that there's any string program. It's not a, right, a common thing. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, the pandemic, of course, cut my touring career for that time. Yeah. And I was just home. And so actually the Halifax Regional Arts, which is, I suppose, a partner with the Halifax School Board, they facilitate all of the violin lessons around HRM. Mm-hmm. So here, all of the schools, almost all of the schools inside Halifax and just around Halifax have violin.
Wow.
Yeah, it's awesome. Because when I was growing up, only the schools in downtown Halifax had that. So I was actually shipped from my home for 1 hour on the bus to get to a school so that I could play violin.
From what age, Gina?
I started that when I was 11.
No, but the kids now in school. Is it elementary?
Grade four. So in grade three, you register to start the program in grade four. So nine around.
Okay.
Yeah. And also cello, and there are some violas as well for kids who want to do that, which is great. But yeah, so they asked me, and I had done a lot of workshops like you, like going into the school, doing a workshop or something, and then leaving, right? So that's fun and the end of it. I never imagined that I would be a violin teacher in the school system for a variety of reasons. But then COVID happened and this call came and I was so hurting for work, you know, I'll take it. And it's in my field. So I was actually super, super grateful to get that gig. And then I liked it. I liked it way more than I thought I would.
Yeah.
There's a lot of bureaucratic stuff that I don't like about the school system. And it really is a system. And I can see a lot of similarities to other systems that I also don't support. But that's why I feel like it's even more important to get like genuine, loving, caring people into that system. And the kiddos that I was working with were awesome. Like they challenged me in a way that none of my private students ever could. And I liked that, you know, I liked it. I really, really had to think in different ways. And it was super challenging because we only had a half an hour a week with these groups.
Okay.
Now, normally the groups would be bigger, but with COVID, they had to be a smaller class size, thankfully. I don't know, like, how I'm going to handle a bigger class size. But the smaller group was manageable, but half an hour a week was really challenging. So it was just about keeping their interest and trying to get them to play at home.
And this was in person? You were able to be in person?
At first it was in person, then we went into lockdown. It was online. Then we got lifted back into person, and then lockdown online. Yeah.
So you can't play with people synchronously online.
No.
So with beginners, are you doing call and response? How are you managing that online?
Yep. I will say it benefited quite a bit the students, most of the students, to be online. I was super surprised. And it's because they're all muted, right? Yeah. So at least for that one half hour, now they're playing for a whole half hour.
Yeah.
Whereas before, they weren't necessarily playing for a half hour if we were taking turns or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And then they can unmute and play their little thing, and I can give one-on-one instruction, and then they mute again and practice what I just said. Mm-hmm. So we actually had all of the people in the class playing different pieces.
Okay.
Some were cruising through, and some were having struggles, right? So I could see the benefit of that, but we weren't playing together. Like you said, so there was no feeling of like ensemble. There was no feeling of togetherness and that kind of special way that you get when you're with one another playing. Mm-hmm. So I feel possibly in the future there will be like a hybrid of some online stuff and in-person stuff, just as a keeper, you know, from COVID.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But I'm about to go do an education degree to come back and to continue this work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And do you incorporate some improvisation games in your work in the classroom?
Oh, yeah, right away. That's one of the first things that we do.
What can you tell us what kind of things you do with them?
Well, even just right away, like, ba-da-bop, ba-da-bop, just to get them, like, some energy out. Because as a new person, you know, there's all these funny energies in the room.
Yeah.
So just yell a little bit. But controlled yelling.
Yeah.
You know? Certain things like even yell as loud as you can, and then now whisper as soft as you can, you know, so they're using dynamics and stuff. They're not even necessarily like cognizant of that, but they're expelling energy. And then when you get them to be really quiet, now they're like more present, right? Mm-hmm. And paying attention. So then we can say, okay, get your violins. And then I usually do a call and response, like a hot jazz style call and response over minor swing. So I'll play the chords on the piano, and I'll say ba-da, ba-da, da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, and just get them to use like two notes or even one note, A and E usually we start with. Mm-hmm. And then they really feel like they're making music, you know, they're making something that sounds good. They're making it up out of their head. I mean, it is a call and response, but they're still doing it, you know. Mm-hmm. And it usually takes a few weeks to settle into this, but I try by the end of the year to have every person be the caller at least once, you know, so that they can all experience that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of my go-to, like right off the bat, that's what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk about what it was like when you first started to improvise in public? I believe you have a story about that.
It was absolutely terrible. It was so embarrassing. Oh man. Yeah, well, the very, very first time I was asked to improvise was actually even before a band I played with called Gypsophilia. So before that, someone asked me to improvise on one of their songs, and it was in G major. And they just said, you know, it's G, just do whatever you want. And they played the track, and there was nothing. Like, I wish I could enter this state in meditation. There was nothing in my head. And they stopped. You know, and they said, okay, we're going to try again. Okay, yep, pop it on. So they popped it on. Nothing. And I just burst into tears. I just cried in their recording studio. And I said, I'm so sorry. Like, I can't do this. I don't know what to do. And so that was the first kernel, which was still inside of me when Gypsophilia kind of started. And I had never improvised in front of other people. I had never really improvised ever in my life. Even to just pick up my violin and play something, I would play Bach or something, you know? So it was never mine. And then I started playing with this band, Gypsophilia, and we were started to get really popular really fast, lots of gigs, booked solid. And every single time we played, I mean, the style of the song is to like play the head, every person takes a solo and the head out, right? So we would play the head and every person would take a solo and then it would come to me and I would literally put my violin behind my back and just be like, no, no. Or just, nope, next, just point to the next person. And then finally, one of my bandmates said, you know, we're all working really hard to play these concerts and you're cutting out of your solo every song, every night. So we're holding your check. until you solo, we're going to keep your money, basically. So that was a really good incentive to start to play. And my very first solos were just, I listened back. I have them all on CD. It's cute. Like, I look back with such tenderness at that person, you know, who was completely out of their comfort zone, completely anxious in their mind. But the only thing coming out was like, D, 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 G, D, 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 low D, D. That's the end. So it's been quite a learning curve since then.
Mm-hmm. Is there advice you'd give the younger Gina looking back?
Just relax. Like, my goodness, just chill out a little bit, you know? Yeah, because the anxiety was coming from this place of like, I'm not good enough. I don't sound like these guys. Do you know what it was, actually? I will tell you. I wanted to sound like Stefan Grappelli. Mm-hmm. And there was this one magical day where I had the revelation of like, no, I don't want to sound like Stefan Grappelli. I want to sound like Gina Burgess. Mm-hmm. And then boom, it was just that like mind flip. Mm-hmm. Everything changed to me. Then I wasn't trying, you know, I was just doing, just being. Mm-hmm. And that was very helpful. And I started to enjoy the music more. So I started to move a little bit more. Like, even the first footage of me playing with Gypsophilia, my music stand was there. I was very serious, you know. The band said, ditch the stand. My God, just get rid of that. It's like, okay, that was scary. But I did it. Started memorizing the tunes, memorizing the chord changes, and then feeling the chord changes. Oh, these are all the same. They're just in different keys, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was a process. But as soon as I stopped trying to sound like anyone else, that's where it all happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard through the grapevine that Stefan Grappelli was actually pretty insecure, and he had, I guess maybe, I don't know if it was later in his career, but he had it in his contract, he would only play certain tunes in certain keys.
Huh,
if you
really
want to play with him, yeah.
Wow, I wish I could put that in my contract.
Really though?
Kind of. Like, no, not necessarily, but actually I did have an experience last summer. It was in COVID. Holy, like, I hadn't improvised in the jazz style in a long time because, like, basically I'm playing a lot of rock and roll right now, folk, mm-hmm. rock, I don't even know what to call it, but not jazz. Mm-hmm. And I got hired to do this gig, and I'm not going to say who it was. She definitely knows. But I got the charts, and I was a little bit cocky. I won't even lie to you. You know, I thought, oh, I can do this. I listened to the tunes a couple of times. I didn't even look at the music. Mm. I just thought, yep, I got this. And then I went to the studio. I did not have it. Mm. Oh, man, I did not have it at all. And the chords were out there chords, like, with all of these extensions, you know, that I hadn't thought about in 8-9 years. Mm-hmm. And it was brutal. I even said at one point to the engineer, like, I can't do this. Just, you're going to have to get someone else to do this. I'm quitting. He's like, Gina, you can do this. You can. Like, let's stick with it. And he helped me a little bit. And honestly, God love him. Like, he did some studio magic to make that album. But I learned so much from that. Like, those are the experiences. It's one thing to just sound great all the time and do your thing, right? But it's those experiences that level up you, yeah, as a musician, you know? So I'm thankful for that experience, but it was super uncomfortable. And that was only like last summer, you know?
Yeah, because it's such a different language to play any kind of jazz. But I think we all have to push outside our comfort levels all the time as musicians, or we will just kind of stagnate, right?
Yep, totally.
But I understand, like, I wonder about, like, especially like the rock world, people play their anthems, like, they're expected. If they do a big stadium show, people want to hear that tune they've been loving for 10, 20 years. But maybe that artist just really wants to play new material only.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
So there has to be a balance, I'm guessing, when you're touring.
There does. I've experienced that with Gypsophilia, and I've experienced that with the Jerry Cans. Mm-hmm. And hopefully I'll experience it with my solo album someday.
Well, let's talk about this too. Yeah.
Yeah, no, you do need a balance because, like, of course, as I was saying earlier, like, the audience is part of the band, right? So if they're really longing to hear this song, Ook Yook, for example, is our, like, big hit with the Jerry Cans. And, like, I think to myself every gig, I'm so glad I love this song. I'm so glad because we will be playing that song well, for the whole time we're a band. Like, we'll never stop playing that song because that's what people love. I think if it were something that I really disliked, you know, that would be another story. But you need that balance to play them some new stuff and some stuff that's that they love and that they know and they can sing along to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you, Gina. That was beautiful.
You're welcome.
So your new solo album is coming out soon?
I don't know.
Okay.
I've been working on it for 6 years. So there's no rush. But I am feeling like it's soon. The chicken is ready to hatch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So have you recorded anything in the studio yet or just working on tunes?
Oh, no. It's all done. It's mastered.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I recorded it I recorded the whole thing in Dartmouth at New Scotland Yard. That's Joel Plaskett's studio, super beautiful space. So I was really thankful for that. I got a grant to do that. And then had it produced in Montreal at Break Glass Studios with Jace, who is the last Jerry Cans producer. Mm-hmm. And I wanted him in particular to do this album because I had worked with him with the Jerry Cans, so I knew our vibe worked. But also he, through the Jerry Cans and through some other projects, has worked with throat singers. So I know he knows how to mix them, how to hear them properly, and all of that. So I got another grant to do that, which was super. And it just got mastered like a few weeks ago. Now I'm working with this buddy who's in Thailand right now, but for the album art. Mm-hmm. It's called Is Now. That's the name of the album, Is Now. And it's maybe next summer, I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I'm in school, so I don't really want to release it while I'm in school.
Right.
But yeah, then I feel like it will be time.
So what kind of music is on this album? Is it a mix of styles or...?
Yep, I'd say. It's super eclectic, actually. So there's some pieces on there, like one I wrote while I was doing my yoga teacher's training, and it's called mm-hmm. Something New, and it's basically like a piece of solo Bach, like one of the sonatas or something. So it's very much in that style. Mm-hmm. And then that has a sister piece called SOS that I wrote when I was really needing help, but like unable to ask for it, and then actually unable to receive it when it was offered. So just seeing this whole situation happening. So I wrote it called SOS, and I actually took that tune. So it's on my solo album, but it's also on the last Jerry Cans album as well. Mm-hmm. And it's super fascinating to hear the two renditions, I guess, if mm-hmm. you will. But that one is with a delay pedal. So I've been using some different pedals in all different situations. And yeah, this one's pretty heavy. So it uses a delay pedal, distortion pedal, and the SOS one is very melancholy. And I would actually recommend looking at the Jerry Cans video that we have right now. We had this dancer from Toronto moving in a way that almost looks like a boomerang, mm-hmm. but it's to represent that she's stuck.
Right? I saw that, yeah.
Yeah.
Really moving.
Isn't it amazing? Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I got that back, I was just, actually, I cried. I cried and cried, and I watched it again and cried more. And of course, we put it out in the pandemic. So yeah. We weren't planning for that at all. But of course, everyone was stuck. And it was just perfect timing, you know? Mm-hmm. And with the whole social medias, I don't know if you noticed, there's some scenes where they're looking at their screen and it's just flashing in front of their face. Like, yeah, that's a big part of our lives, right? So we need to have balance with that. And that's a big part of that piece. So it was interesting to play it my way, I guess, or not even my way, but with the people on my solo project in that group versus the Jerry Cans. Mm-hmm. Then there's like some folky tunes more so. Actually, someone labeled them my Klez Breton, which I love. I love that term. So I'm using klezmer scales, mm-hmm. but the chord progression is like a Cape Breton fiddle tune. Mm-hmm. So it does the whole classic, like, go down a step, then come back up mm-hmm. a step. So there's two songs on there like that, one of which actually has, we just finished a music video for, my very first music video, which I'm really excited for. What else is on there? There's a dance tune, like a very, very trancey. So I love this idea of classical trance. So it's very much like Philip Glass or Steve Reich. Those are my heroes, like, big heroes. Terry Riley actually is number one big hero. I just love that minimalist, repetitive, trance-like stuff. So I do a lot of that. And of course, throat singing is that too, which is why I think I love throat singing so much, because you get into that you can get into that mystical state mm-hmm. through repetition. Mm-hmm. So some of the pieces on there are like that too. I remember developing some of these pieces, and I was crashing at my mom's place in between tours. And one piece I thought, oh, this is it. I've just nailed it. This is perfect. And my grandma comes into my room and she's like, God, Gina, that's enough to drive you mad. I was like, I did get it. Perfect. Thanks, Grammy. So it's not for everybody, but I feel like on this album, there is something for everybody, you know? Mm-hmm. And it just happened that way. I wasn't trying to do anything. It just happened like that.
So you mentioned pedals. So is that just like part of your process too with working on pieces?
The pedals actually came from playing with Gypsophilia.
Okay.
And the guitar players in that band, of course, used pedals. Mm-hmm. And I've always been intrigued. And then I heard, Final Fantasy at the time, but Owen Pallett play, and I was looking at his pedal board and just like totally amazed and intrigued.
Mm-hmm.
And again, going back to this whole trance idea, you can do that with loopers, you know, and different, I love delay for mm-hmm. whatever reason. And so I started experimenting with Gypsophilia. That was the very first time actually that I used a pedal, and it was very minimal, but it was great. And then I brought those same pedals to the Jerry Cans and started playing with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I only have three pedals that I use at the moment. I'm not techie like in any way, so they need to be super easy. But I can definitely see why people call it like the rabbit hole, because
mm-hmm.
once you get into it, like you could really get into it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but then you have to carry them everywhere too. So I remind myself of that.
Did you use a looper when you were in isolation this pandemic year for sort of the feeling of playing with people?
I did. Yep. Yeah, I did. I actually, right now I have a different one rented from Long & McQuaid, an even easier one. It's
mm-hmm.
one button. That's what I said. I want one with one button, and they had one. So, yeah, I've been playing with that a little bit, and playing actually the only gigs that I really had like fairly consistently through the pandemic was at, this wine restaurant where I live called Wine Grunt,
mm-hmm.
and they love wine and they love music. So we were always allowed to have one player through COVID. So I brought my looper, and that was kind of the first time that I used my looper in front of people,
mm-hmm.
because I don't use it with the band, and it's nerve-wracking to use it in front of people. But this was kind of background music, and honestly, like we were only allowed having 12 people in the bar or something, and they were all my family and friends.
Yeah.
So it was a safe space to try these things. It definitely doesn't have the feeling of playing with other people.
Yeah.
No. But it was fun.
Do you write at the keyboard a little bit too?
No. I write when I'm walking around and songs come into my head
okay.
when I'm walking. So I just take my cell phone
mm-hmm.
and I sing into my cell phone.
Okay.
Yeah, sometimes my bandmates will get these really hilarious like little voice memos. But usually those are the beginning of the songs. And actually I know quite a few other musicians who are inspired while they're walking.
Sure. Yeah. And when you're improvising, do you tend to hear it right before you're playing it or as you're playing it, like the next note's coming, or is it, do you surprise yourself?
That's a really good question. I think I hear it. There's also, not cliches, kind of cliches, but like little licks, I guess, like the building blocks, our Lego blocks. I say
yeah.
to students, you know, we have our, instead of our bag of tricks, we have our bag of licks. And each one of those is like how you make your
mm-hmm.
improvs. But that can get a little bit redundant, right? So, yeah, there are ways to explore sound with less of a mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Gina, thanks for agreeing to do a little improv with me.
Yes, I'm happy to.
Do you want to start?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
I think that's good.
Okay, thank you. It was fun.
That was beautiful.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, you're so welcome. I really appreciated you being interested and asking me. It means a lot.
Oh, of course.
Season one of this podcast had 20 episodes, and season two continues with a really interesting mix of musicians talking about their lives and careers with perspectives on overcoming challenges, finding inspiration and connection through a life so enriched with music. Please follow this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts to be informed about each new episode.